accession number 13460, reel 2.
And they're just about starting then.
So you were flying day fighters, effectively?
No. At times, I didn't do that then. No, there weren't all that many of them. But perhaps I got it slightly wrong. They hadn't really started yet then. We were still in pure night fighting. And there was the occasional raid during the night, but there are more night fighters than Germans, really. So we were very lucky even to get behind one. And there was very little activity. I got behind one Messerschmitt 410 on one occasion, starting. He was going towards London and starting very high up, about 30,000 feet. And I wasn't sure what it was. I was told it was a bogey. Could have been enemy aircraft. So I closed in on him. He was taking a rather sharp evasive action. So I thought it must be a German. And got to where I could see him. He was heading for London, diving all the time. I was diving pretty fast. And then I saw him and shot at him, and as I shot, he shot back at me. So I said, thank God for that. It's not a mosquito, because they looked very much the same from behind. And so I hit him, and he went down like that, again, probably into the sea of in the Thames Estuary. In fact, he dropped his bombs somewhere when I was in shot at. So I had two radar blips on the screen. One went absolutely straight down, the other one slightly less straight down, but both pretty well down. So again, that was a probable, not a confirmed one. And that's the only time, two times, I've been in the air at the same time as a German, and twice I'd actually done something about them. There wasn't an awful lot doing.
Now, were you with mosquitoes for the rest of the war?
No. I was eventually caught out. Our boss, the admiral, sent for me and said, I've got a job for you. We need people for the transport unit in Scotland. So I don't want to be a transport pilot. I got a very good job as it is, as a night fighter. And I said, no, you've been at it for too long. We haven't had a rest period yet. And this is supposed to be a rest period. It's a civilian unit, flying Lodestars, operating under British Airways, or BOAC, as it was. And you just got to take it. So I had to join it. And they're flying between Scotland and Stockholm.
So in Lodestars?
Yes. So I thought, well, yeah, it could be quite fun and to join it. And I thought also, well, there's not much future in this night flying business, night fighting business, until there is an invasion or something. And that doesn't seem to be coming, so I might as well get some useful experience, because at the time I was going to go on flying after the war, and I thought Lodestar could be a useful airplane to have in your logbook as an airline pilot. And so it was. I did about 50 trips between Scotland and Stockholm in just over a year. And I was doing that when the war stopped. It was great fun. Most dangerous flying I've ever done. Because more people are shot down on that run than in any squadron I've ever been with.
Were you unarmed?
Yes, totally unarmed.
And what was your maximum speed?
Oh, not a lot. Just under 300 miles an hour, I think.
Did you run into any trouble at all?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. We knew the trouble spots. We had our own routes across Norway and our own way of flying. We were left entirely to our own devices, how to get there, when to get there. And we had usually got in to between Stavanger and Bergen, one of those deep fjords into Norway, and dive down to sea level at the entrance of the fjord and followed it in and up across the mountains. And
nice.
Yes, it was great flying, marvelous flying. And the people there, they were old airline pilots. Not the faintest idea about night fighting, night or fighting flying at all. And I could tell them a lot about it, how to evade night fighters, because most of this time we've been doing practice runs up and down a channel. There were always two of us in our Mosquitoes or a bow fighter practicing interception of each other. And we became pretty good at avoiding each other, because if you have radar, then there's hardly any way that anybody can catch you at night. You've got to be a bloody good pilot to do that. And so by this time, we had a rearward-looking radar, or radar warning, shall we say, on the Lodestar. So we knew when things were after us, and I knew that nobody could catch me, because the Lodestar was quite a nice little airplane, fairly reasonably fast and quite maneuverable. I knew I could practically outmaneuver Junkers 88, which is what they would have. So that didn't worry me a little bit. And quite true, we had three lights on this radar, warnings. Faint red light, which was for general surveillance. Well, that was on always, all the time, so we knew that we were...
This was ground radar.
Yes, we knew we were being observed. And stronger red light, which was tied into the gun radar. We'd got this from Bomber Command. Incidentally, they'd used it over Germany. And this had a delay built into it. They used it at about between 15 and 20,000 feet. And, of course, Germany was absolutely stiff with guns, radar controlled, always searching. So they had a delay built in, so they knew when the light came on, the shell was on its way up, which gave you plenty of time to take evasive action, of course, because it takes quite a few seconds to get up there. But the trouble was that this was for, say, 15,000 feet, and it hadn't been readjusted for us. And it hit me once at 4,000 feet. I just over the east of Norway, just north of Oslo, had come down through cloud. We had no means of navigation except dead reckoning, no radio navigation at all. And I'd come down gingerly through cloud, knew roughly where I was, but not exactly. And I thought I was maybe just north of Oslo. And then all of a sudden, I saw four bright sparks below me. And I knew where I was, and that was a very good pinpoint. That could only be Gardermoen, because that was the only fortified place in that part of the world. And four bright flashes could only mean a battery of four 88mm guns.
That's a big airfield north of Oslo,
yes.
Which is now a major airport.
That's right, yeah. And I knew that place very well. But so the moment I saw that, I was in a vertical turn, of course, which does as well. But as I was turning, my light came on, and as the light came on, four shells burst where I should have been. And I collected one little piece of shrapnel in an engine. It's the only thing I collected on the wall.
And that's the closest you got to being shot down on this trip.
Mm.
What were you carrying and who were you carrying?
Passengers. They ball bearings, they said, mostly passengers, people who escaped from Norway, and diplomats and spies, what have you, between Sweden and Norway. Not a lot of people going to Norway, mostly coming out from Sweden.
And being an airline-operated aircraft with no armament, it didn't infringe Swedish neutrality?
No. We had to operate under BOAC rules because the international law there was such that you couldn't have your own airline operating between two foreign countries. So we had to be British. In fact, I got a British passport then. So while I was in Stockholm, I was British. In Scotland, I was Norwegian. So that took me through the end of the war.
But you still got paid by Norway?
Yes. Fortunately.
No, because they had mosquitoes on this trip as well.
Yes, they did. Yes.
But they were less comfortable. You had to lie in the Bombay or something.
That's right, yes. There are many funny stories about that. But they're great chaps, the mosquito pilots. Of course, they could... we sometimes could make a return trip at night. There are lots of opinions about that. For instance, these old pilots, they said you must never fly in bright moonlight because then they can see you. So I said, they can see me whether it's moonlight or not. They got radar. That's how we saw people. In moonlight, I can see them as well. And as a night fighter, I always felt very vulnerable in moonlight because I was as good a target as my targets were. They couldn't understand that. And in moonlight, I can go down on the deck, even over the mountains, in which case there's nobody who can catch me. If I fly at 200 feet, I was in fact doing what they're doing nowadays, but not automatically, contour flying, there's nobody who can catch me at all. I knew that was impossible. They just couldn't see this. And they didn't fly in that sort of thing. I said, if you can't let me fly, you put a foot down, I shall not fly again with you at all. I'll go somewhere else. So I had my own way on that. So again, you see, I wasn't... I never believed in doing what I was told.
No. So that was really the end of your wartime service,
yes,
as a military pilot?
Yes. I stayed in the Air Force for about, till the end of the year. I couldn't get out until then. But at the end of the year, they couldn't keep me, and I got a job in Swedish Airlines. I got fed up with waiting for the Norwegians. Couldn't make up their mind how to start the airline, and got an offer in from Sweden.
I mean, what about your family and so on? You hadn't been able to keep contact with them?
No.
During the war?
No, they were all right. They hadn't suffered enormously. They'd gone without not the essentials of life, but they had a hard time. Very difficult time. Some of my family had gone over to Sweden. An uncle of mine, who was a director of an armament factory in Norway, he'd been forced by the Germans to cooperate, and then he escaped to Sweden, and his family joined him there. So the last few times I'd been to Sweden, I'd seen them, so they had some news from Norway.
And when did you meet your wife? Did you meet her during the war? Or after
yes,
the war?
Yes, she was. She was with BOAC as a ground hostess. In fact, she was the sister of our adjutant in my last squadron. Great friend of John Cunningham and myself. So we got married just after the war ended.
Can we turn now to your experiences after the war? You became an airline pilot, I believe.
Yes, I got a job with Swedish Airlines, ABA, it was, later part of SAS. Quite a straightforward job, flying DC-3s and DC-4s around European runs, routes.
Which was not a Bromma, was it?
Yes, that's right. So we lived in Stockholm, which was quite nice after wartime Norway and England. They had everything there. They thought it had been hard done by, but nothing like the rest of Europe, of course. And it was quite pleasant. Rather too full of Swedes, of course. But there were quite a lot of English and American pilots as well. Three Norwegians, including myself.
And what was airline flying in those days compared to, say, European flying now? I mean, what was air traffic control like? And the skies are relatively empty.
Absolutely empty. Beautiful, yes. You hardly had to look out at all. And there was no radar control or anything like that. And there's very little in the way of things like ILS, that sort of thing, hardly existed at all. So
it's instrument landing system.
Yes. Yeah.
So you flew visual.
I flew visual most of the time, yes. Sometimes you had to get up through cloud and then to be let down, you get from point to point beacons. And there were let down procedures which were very basic compared to what they are nowadays. And it was quite pleasant, very leisurely, and flying at about 200, 250 miles an hour, DC-4.
And what heights typically?
Oh, 8,000 feet, the standard height, 6,000 or 8,000 feet. They were unpressurized, so I didn't want to get any higher than that. 6,000 feet was the ideal height over most of Europe.
And I suppose most of the airports were still military bases, were they? I mean,
oh, no. Places like Bromma had never been military. And London, we used Northolt. There was military control. Paris, Le Bourget, that sort of place. They were not particularly military. No.
Did you fly to Croydon at all?
Not on this sort of run, no. We used Croydon at the end of the war, just after the war. The Norwegian Air Force used it between London and Oslo. I was still doing that sort of flight then in the Air Force.
Could you fly Stockholm, London non-stop?
Oh, yes.
You had the range for
yes,
it.
Yes, no problem.
Because those presumably would be DC-4s.
Yes, DC-3s would do it as well. The main runs were Stockholm to London, Paris, Rome, Lisbon.
How long were you flying with Swedish Airlines?
Nearly 4 years. Then I was getting a bit impatient with that because it was rather boring. You just sat there. There was nothing else to do. You'd get up and plug in the autopilot and looked out every now and then. If you got your stewardesses nicely trained, they would bring you a cup of coffee the moment you settled in the climb, and that was it. And it went back and forth. It was quite interesting at that time, flying around Europe, because, I hadn't been around Europe at all. I hadn't never had a chance of doing that. And we had quite a few night stops in places like Paris, Lisbon, Rome, Athens, and so on. And so I got to know those places very well, which was very interesting. And very enjoyable. I like getting places going places like that. But once you've done it, well, there's a limit to how many times you can do the same run, I think. And I was beginning to think perhaps there's something more in it than this. And I was thinking of starting the, going on the transatlantic run on DC-6s. And I'm just passing my checkout on the DC-6 for this purpose. But I wasn't terribly enthusiastic because I thought the Atlantic run was even more boring than the European one. Just New York and nothing else at all. And I wasn't terribly keen on New York. I never have been. And across the Atlantic, only just plug in 7 hours and that's it. And then I got a call from John Cunningham saying we're starting a new thing, a civil airliner, jet, and we want people to fly it. And he was looking for people he knew, basically, because that's how the whole thing works, isn't it? In this part of the world, anyway. And not only that, people with airline practice, so I had by then, and people with high-speed practice, which he knew I had from the mosquitoes. You couldn't get anything more faster than that at that time. So he thought I was a good choice for that, so I accepted immediately, of course, because that was anybody's dream, to be right in the forefront of flying on an exciting new airplane back to England, which I liked. My wife was English. She wouldn't mind that, I thought. And I always liked England. I didn't like Stockholm particularly. I wasn't terribly keen on Norway either. It was too small and no opportunities for anything at all. Wonderful scenery, but I can't live on that.
Did you have children by this time?
No. No, my wife had two children. We never had any apart from that.
Now, you joined de Havilland's in where? About 49, was
49, it? Yes. And I think it was February 49, yes.
And it was quite a busy place at that time, wasn't
it? Oh, very busy. They just started on the Comet, just about beginning to fly. I couldn't be on the first flight of it because I was still Norwegian. For some strange reason, you know how the British are with secrecy. They're absolutely terrified letting anybody know anything at all. And I wasn't allowed to fly with it in case I told the Norwegians about it or something. And John was very angry about this. And he put his foot down and said, I could at least fly as a co-pilot with him, which I did quite some time. So, but it took me some time to be checked out on it. I got my British nationality as soon as I could, because technically I was qualified for it with just a short stay in England immediately before getting it. All my war years counted as residence in England. And meanwhile, I was doing odd jobs like flying vampires, which is a good introduction to jet flying. And of course, de Havilland had large orders from vampires from all around Europe. Apart from the RAF, I could fly Swiss, Swedish, Norwegian vampires. And I did the testing and delivery of those. Most of those were more advanced than the RAF vampires. So I wasn't allowed to touch an RAF vampire at all.
In what ways were they more advanced? More powerful engines?
Different equipment and various things. Later models. But
more expensive specifications?
Yes, yes. And I wasn't allowed to fly a Mosquito. Because that was RAF, the British. So it was really rather stupid. But I enjoyed my vampire flying. Got quite a few flights to Norway and Switzerland. Swiss had ordered 50 of these, and I delivered, I think, 25 of them. It was great fun. Very perilous flying again. The Vampire they had ordered had a range of about, or an endurance, we'll say, 15 minutes more than it took flying from Hatfield to Switzerland in good conditions. So we had a chap there. We called him immediately before, saying, "Can you see Mount Pilatus?" And he said, "Yes, it looks all right from here. There's a few clouds about, but I think it'll stay like it is for maybe an hour and a half." So let's rush into the aeroplane, get off, and make it. Absolutely no control, no flight control, whatever. No flight planning. We flew exactly as we wanted. Absolute straight line between Hatfield and Lucerne.
Cruising altitude what?
Oh, up to about 42,000. Nobody asked us about our altitude at all. There was no traffic up there, of course. There was no jet traffic, whatever. So we're way on our own.
Did you not carry drop tanks for ferry flying?
Not on those. On the Norwegians had drop tanks, and the Swedes, but not the Swiss. Swiss being a tiny country, they didn't want to be lumbered with that sort of thing. Because you can fly anywhere. You can fly around Switzerland three times without using a drop tank, probably. So the Swiss are very, well, they're cost conscious, quality conscious, and a funny lot altogether.
Now, what about your experience on first flying? I mean, the Vampire was your first jet you ever flew.
Yes.
Can you remember your first experiences?
Yes, so it's so simple. No problems. For instance, on the Beaufighter, for instance, you're always warned about a terrible swing on takeoff if you weren't careful. You could have the same on a Mosquito. You had to be very gentle on opening throttles and so on. Vampire, there's no question of warming up or anything like that. You start up, and once the thing got up to full power, you just put the throttle on the stops. Off you went. That's absolute straight line. It was so simple, so beautiful, marvellous.
You had no braking either, the prop gave you.
If you
went on the throttle back, you had a certain amount of braking effect.
Yes. No, it was an entirely new, different technique of flying, of course. So what you had to learn, and I suppose a few people may have come to grief on that, but if you have plenty of runway to start with and learn how to do it, then once you're on a jet, it's much the same on most jets. It was until you got the reverse thrust, of course, which didn't happen for many years later. No, it was very simple flying.
You had to keep the revs up fairly high because of the response.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Once you learn the technique, it's applicable to any jet, big or small, of course. And there's the different element of time. Many people don't seem to learn that. You fly at least twice as fast as you've ever done before in your life. And that means you've really got to think twice as fast as well. And some people keep their thinking on the same level. I found that so many times on instructing pilots later. That's the biggest difficulty of all.
Of course, the increased performance, and of course the increase in control response as well was delightful, I suppose. Your maneuvers were so much crisper, were they?
No, I wouldn't say that. Mm-hmm. No. I never come across anything as maneuverable as that first Armstrong Whitworth fighter I told you about.
The Scimitar.
That's fantastic. You can take off, straight off, and go into half loop, half roll, half loop again, and you can climb that way. That's fabulous. It could do that with a modern fighter, but not quite with a Vampire. It wasn't quite powerful enough for that.
Did you fly the Venom as well?
No, I didn't at that time, because that was ordered by the Air Force only. So I wasn't allowed on that. And by the time I was, I had my nationality fixed, I wasn't really terribly interested in that. On the Comet, and the full time.
Who were the other people around de Havilland at the time? I mean, the other pilots. Can you remember a lot of them?
Oh, yes. Well, the first one was John Cunningham. John Derry, who was a fantastic pilot.